What happens when we think? When we come to study sensation, we must remember that it is impossible for us to tell what a pure sensation is like, because we never feel a pure sensation. Every sensation we get after babyhood is mixed up with the memories it revives. We also must remember another very important thing. One old wrong view of the mind, wrong even though it was held by so great a man as John Locke, was that it is like a smooth white sheet of paper on which the outside world comes and prints its marks. According to this view, the mind, like a sheet of paper, is quite passive. It does nothing when we receive sensations, save only to accept them. It contributes nothing at all of its own, and all that can be said of it is that it is there, and receives. We now know that this is very far from being the truth. One of the great facts recognized now by all the students of the mind, and seen to be vastly important, is that when things are coming into the mind is not passive, but active. When we hear a piece of music, our minds are doing just as much in their way as the mind and fingers of the player are doing in their way. For one thing, if we are paying attention, that in itself is an act, and, as we all know, sometimes a very difficult one, and just as tiring as hard running or swimming. More than that, many parts of the brain, specially concerned with the subject in hand, are roused to activity when new sensations come in. The mind is always trying to make sense of them, as we say, though the phrase is rather misleading. All the time, though we are quite often unconscious of it, the mind is comparing what has just come in with what has just come in on previous occasions, putting two and two together, saying this must be a chair, and that is my brother, or on a higher plane, declaring that this thing is true because something else we know proves it. The higher and better the brain, the more certainly it is doing these things. Whenever we read or look or listen, and therefore nothing can be a greater mistake than to suppose that sensation is a passive process, as when a sheet of paper is written upon. If we have attended carefully to what has just been said, we must have noticed in it hints of another process which follows upon sensation and perception and real attention. That process is what happens when one thing, entering the mind, calls up the memory of another. The name of this process is association. It is usually called the association of ideas, but that is not a very good name, because we associate, more or less, anything and everything that enters or can exist in the mind. Sights, sounds, tastes, feelings, and everything else, as well as ideas, are nearly always associated in the mind. We see that one thing reminds us of another. This is to say that, acting through memory, one thing is associated with another. But association is not limited to just the times when we notice and remark how one thing suggests another into our minds. It is really going on all the time, in small things as well as in great, faintly, as when we are just noticing things in a general way, or vividly, as when we are thinking with all our might. The wonderful way in which our thoughts are linked together. The first man to write down anything like a clear account of this great law of association was the Englishman Thomas Hobbes, and this subject has always been studied more especially in England than anywhere else since his time. It is very interesting that, in later years, we have been able, by studying the course of the fibers in the brain from one part to another, to get some key to the way in which association works. Certainly these discoveries would have deeply interested Thomas Hobbes. We realize now that all thinking is relationing, as it is called, that is to say, associating. We can understand how it is that the greater part of the human brain consists of association cells and association fibers. They are not directly concerned with any kind of sensation, but are concerned with linking up our sensations so that, by a gradual and orderly process, it is possible for our minds to pass from an infant's first dim appreciation of the difference between light and darkness to the highest ideas which we can have, such as the conception of the nature of light and the power whence it springs. How all our thinking depends upon our memory. Though association is so wonderful and lies at the bottom of all thinking, yet the laws of its working are really not difficult to understand. It depends, of course, upon memory. Let us ask ourselves why it is that one thing that calls up another and not something else. and why it calls up one thing to one person and another thing to another person. Why does a cat suggest a mouse to our minds? Or why, to a particular person, should a chair suggest the name of some old friend, perhaps, who has been dead for many years? It is possible to answer these questions fairly well. We associate things when we have seen them at the same time, which would mean an association of place as well as of time. We also associate things because they are like one another, and sometimes, though it sounds curious to say so, one thing suggests another just because that other thing is very different. The last two cases we may call association by likeness and by contrast. These are all the kinds of association that are usually described. But perhaps there is also a kind of association of cause and effect in the minds of people who are apt to think of causes and effects. Probably this is so, because we are sure now that there is a kind of memory which goes by causes. And when we remember a thing because we know the reason for it, this is much the highest type of memory. Clever animals that appear to think like men. Learning of every kind depends upon memory. It is certainly true that all except the very simplest kinds of learning, and perhaps those also, depend upon association. The writer does not believe that human beings are the only creatures that have this power. Animals have it in some degree, and the more intelligent the animal is, the clearer is the evidence we get of the association of ideas. A striking case is that of the old war horse, which, when it was young, plunged into battle at the bugle's call. Years afterwards, the sound of a bugle may rouse it to the most tremendous excitement and expectation, because there has been established in its mind an association of ideas between a bugle and a battle. This association of ideas may, of course, be noticed in dogs. Indeed, there is no doubt that dogs have a certain amount of power of reasoning, and there can be no reasoning without association of ideas. In human beings, the power of association varies enormously, and, on the whole, we may say that, beyond a doubt, the greater, the deeper, the wider, the richer, the more varied the power of association in a person, the higher and finer is the mind of that person. But we must particularly add that the quality of the associations made counts for everything. To one man, it may be the mere surface which suggests something else. But to another man, it is the truth underneath. The different things a name may bring into two men's minds. The lowest kind of association worth mentioning at all is the case of punning. Though, of course, punning may be amusing and delightful in its way, but there is all the difference in the world between the man to whom the word Socrates suggests some joke about a sock or a rat, and the man whom it reminds of the death of Socrates and his words, "Fear not for me. To the good man no evil things can happen." Each of these is a case of the association of ideas, but the one man is only a punster and the other is a thinker. As association is so all-important, how far may we hope to improve it in ourselves and others? Can we do it so, or can we not? Association depends upon what there is to associate, and that depends on past sensation and perception. To go back to our previous instance, if all that one man knows of Socrates is that he once read a book in which that was the pet name given to a cockatoo, the name of Socrates cannot suggest to him any more than what the book makes possible. But if the sane man, instead of reading that book, had read Plato's account of the death of Socrates, then the name would suggest to him something with a deeper meaning.
Why we should only think of things worth remembering.
One of our great duties towards ourselves, therefore, which we cannot begin to understand or to practice too soon, is first to fill our mind with things worth having, and worth being reminded of by association in after years. Secondly, to avoid, as far as possible, foolish books, the talk of foolish people, and things of that kind which it is not worthwhile to have in our minds at all. And thirdly, to avoid things which are actually wicked, or disgusting, or destructive. These may get into the mind by accident before we know what is happening, and at any moment we are liable to be reminded of them. Even though the purse is rather lean, let us remember that there is no better treasure than a mind well filled with beautiful, true, and valuable memories of noble things seen, noble sounds heard, noble ideas, great poetry, recollection of friends, and so forth. A man with such a mind may say to himself, "My mind to me a kingdom is," or may talk with Wordsworth of that great inward eye which is bliss of solitude. We cannot express too strongly the importance of what has been said about filling the mind with good materials for association. It applies to everybody, whatever his business in life. The artist cannot see too many beautiful sights. The man of science cannot store away in his mind too many truths. And the greatest man of science is the one who has in his mind many truths of different kinds, and who can associate them together.
The difference between brains that can never be altered.
But when all is said and done, the fact remains that there are natural differences between various people, which there is no doing away with or getting over. These differences depend upon something in the making of the brains of the persons in question, and they simply have to be accepted. Different brains vary very much in the number of their association cells and association fibers, and also in the course which the fibers take. We do not know very much yet about the subject from this point of view, for the comparison of brains has really only just begun. But we know a good deal more about it from the study of actual people and the way in which their minds work. Of course, we shall only be confused and come to wrong conclusions if we do not allow properly for the effects of education, and the differences between the contents of different people's minds. Often, of course, it would be difficult to say what extent the differences between people are due to differences in what has been put into their minds, and to what extent they are due to the very nature of their minds. But though we shall often be uncertain, yet still there is clear evidence that people differ naturally in these respects, and also that these differences are the real basis of the differences existing between one man's mind and another, the stupid and the clever man, the poet and the man of science, and so on.
Something that boys and girls can do quicker than older people.
In the first place, there are differences in mere quickness of association. As we all notice in the talk of different people, the process is often extraordinarily quick in children, as their sharp replies testify. In old age, it becomes very much slower. There are also some differences in the variety of association. Some people's minds always running more or less in one direction, while the mind of a great poet like Shakespeare makes associations of every conceivable kind. Some of the special kinds of association are worth noticing, especially as we cannot too soon realize that these differences are natural. If the world were wise, one of the greatest tasks it would set itself would be, in the interest of everybody, to find out quite early the special natural tendencies of different children, and then to try to make the most of them on the lines which nature has dictated. So many lives are spoilt. So much time is wasted, so much misery caused by our trying to make a child into this or that or the other, when the whole structure of his mind, if we could only see it, declares that he will never do that thing well, but might do something else very well indeed. It is true that there are a great many people in whom there is no very marked tendency in any one particular direction. But very often we think that such is the case, when really we have just failed to keep our eyes open.
Why some people are quick and clever at arithmetic.
In some minds, associations are keen and strong in the direction of numbers. No one can say what it is in the brain that decides this, but for practical purposes it really does not matter. The fact remains, counting, calculating, measuring, reckoning, comparing in terms of length and number and quality, all these are things which come naturally, are done with pleasure. Apart from lessons or work, his interests and pleasures and games, the things he wants to know and find out, will largely take the direction of numbering and measuring and calculating. Now, there are many good and useful careers for such a person. But, on the other hand, there are people in whom associations of number are few, slow, difficult, and, indeed, positively unnatural. Though they may take a deep interest in flowers and plants, the face of the sky, the weather, the wind, and so on. Are we right in trying to make bank clerks, shall we say, of these people, or ought they go to a farm to help in the great work of providing food for mankind? While some people think in numbers, others, rather of the same type, think easily and quickly in terms of space. Some like putting things together and taking them to pieces. They like making little toy machines. They want to know the method by which everything works, and are naturally clever in knowing what will fit into a certain space, and how to make a toy work in one way if it will not work in another.
The kind of people who are clever at understanding machines.
These are the practical people to whom engineering probably offers the best careers. Though we must not judge by the tastes which children of 5 or 6 or 7 years old have, as these tastes often come and go. If associations of numbers are strong in these people, so much the better for them. For mathematics and geometry go well with the engineering faculty, and help to make the best engineers. In the highest types of this kind of mind, it is possible not merely to understand associations which earlier minds have formed, but to form new ones which no one has ever formed before. So that a person of this type does not merely understand the old machines, but he can invent new ones. If he be working more at theory than at practice, his powers will show themselves in devising new experiments and new kinds of apparatus for making experiments with. And the practical difficulties, which would utterly dishearten people of another type, give him pleasure to conquer. Other people's minds would simply stop working, but his seems to think more clearly. These are the people who make either great inventors or great experimenters. Adding to our knowledge of heat and electricity and light and so on, Mr. Edison is the finest example alive of this type of mind working at practical invention. And it is certain that if he had chosen to invent machines for experimenting with, instead of inventing things for practical purposes, he would have been no less successful. Such a great worker as Sir Joseph Thomson, president of the British Association, offers an instance of this type of mind devoted to scientific experiment. Lord Kelvin was the greatest example of the same type of mind in the 19th century, and he divided his time between practical invention and scientific experiment. In each, he was as successful as any man ever was, and he very clearly showed that it is the same type of association which makes the inventor and the man who experiments.
People who can make pictures in their minds.
In inventing and experimenting, in engineering and in geometry, too, there is a good deal of seeing with the mind's eye, making visions in the mind of how things will work, how they will go together, how they will fit, how they may be arranged, and so on. This power of making pictures in the mind is called visualizing, and in all people with this kind of mind, visualizing is very powerful. And it forms their most natural way of thinking. Not only can they call up in their mind very clearly the memory of past percepts, so that if they have once seen a machine work, they can always recall to mind how it worked, but also, as we have seen, they can make new percepts in their mind, and they can make them real, and then we get a new invention, like the steam engine or the phonograph. There is another type of visualizing mind which, though it is the same in a way, is very different in the type of mind which we have been discussing. Associations of cause and effect, and also a good deal of calculating, commonly come in. These people are not much concerned with the outside appearances of thing. They perhaps take no particular pleasure in beautiful color or form, but yet there is another kind of visualizing, not at all scientific or invented, and yet valuable in its own way, where the associations in the person's mind go more by the appearances of things, and especially by comparisons and recollections of their form and color, their light and shade, their appearances at different times of the day, at different times of the year, and so forth.
The things that help to make artists or sculptors.
In the autumn, some people can call up clearly in their mind's eye the vision of what a certain landscape looked like in the spring. It is natural for them to notice these things, and to make these comparisons or associations. When they are talking to people, they do not attend very particularly to the tones of the voice, and they are perhaps not particularly interested in what is being said, but they are watching and remembering and comparing what other people never notice at all. Even in the faces of people that they love, the movement of the eyelids, the little tricks of the lips, the poise and the movement of the head, and so on. These people are the artists, drawers, painters, sculptors, architects, and decorators. It is unfortunately true that artistic people usually despise the scientific people because they care so little for beauty and often make such ugly things. And the scientific people, in their turn, despise the artistic people for caring too much about the mere surface of things, and being so little interested in what lies behind them. But when men get wiser, they will learn how foolish all this is, and that both these kinds of people are necessary, for it takes all sorts of people to make a world.
People who think by sound rather than by sight.
Now, there is another great type of mind, and this is found in two very different kinds of people, but they both agree in that the associations for which their brains are best fitted do not go so much by the eye as by the ear. All the other people, on the whole, may be classified as visualizers, and their way of thinking is mostly visualizing, or making visions, old or new, in their minds. But in these other people we are speaking of, the power of visualizing is much less strong, and their chief way of thinking, that is to say, of forming associations, is by sounds and not by sights. In such an animal as the dog, associations go chiefly by smell, but in human beings smell has lost its importance, and only sounds and sights need be considered. So these people who think and associate mostly by sounds are called auditives.
How we hear in our minds the sound of a word that we see.
Man has learnt to do many wonderful things, and especially has learnt to write down marks which stand for sounds. And this invention of written language, and the making and reading of books, really belongs to the working of this kind of mind, though actual hearing and sound may not come in. Nevertheless, we imagine the sounds of the words as we read them, and so, though we are using our eyes to read, and do not seem to be using our ears at all, yet the processes that go on in the brain and in the mind are practically the same as those which go on when we listen to a person speaking. So we can understand what kind of minds the auditives have. Some of them, the musicians, are deeply interested in sounds just as sounds. They remember tunes and can reproduce them. They can even make new tunes. They can imagine in their minds how one kind of instrument sounds with another, or how certain notes will sound when they are played together, or one after the other. So, just as the artists make pictures, these people make music. It is as easy and natural for a musician to make a tune, and perhaps as impossible to put a machine together, much less to invent a new one, as it is easy for the engineer to invent a machine and impossible for him to invent a tune. Of course, we are not saying that many people do not combine more than one of these powers of association. There are such people, and they must be considered to be very fortunate.
The highest kind of mind that a man can have.
We now come to what is, on the whole, the greatest of all the types of mind, and this belongs to the people whose interests are naturally with words. In them the human mind is at its best. When a person speaks, they are not so much interested in the movement of his lips and eyes as the artist is, nor yet in the tones of his voice as the musician is, but rather the meaning of what he says. Just as a musician remembers the tones and tunes, and the artist remembers the colors and forms, so these people remember words and phrases, and the ideas which words and phrases express. The one type of men can associate lines together to make a picture. Another puts notes together to make a tune, and the third puts words together to make a thought. Now, pictures may be just the same as thousands of pictures before them. Tunes may be just the same as many tunes before them, and so, of course, may sentences, phrases, ideas, and thoughts. But a small number of great people whom we call original, and who make the progress of the world, can not only remember and reproduce these old associations, but they can make new and original ones. And so just as we have great pictures, great statuary, great buildings from one type of mind, or great music from another, so from this last type of mind great thoughts will come.
The wonderful mind of a poet who draws life from the soul.
Every now and again there comes into the world a person whose mind combines both varieties of the auditive type. He not only has ideas made by associating words, but he is also concerned with the musical quality of words, and takes pains to put them together so that they have a pleasant rhythm. This man is a poet. The greatest poets are visualizers as well. They can see great pictures in their minds, as Milton saw pictures when he wrote Paradise Lost, or they can recall appearances of nature, as when Wordsworth wrote his poem about the daffodils. Their minds are so rich, and have so many powers of association, that they can compare things together which other people would not think of comparing. All of these qualities added together, perfectly blended, and governed by something which is deeper than all associations, and which we can only call the soul, went to make the few sublime poets of the world, who thought and saw and heard and felt and sang, remembered and prophesied, and did all these things so well, and blended them so wonderfully, that their poetry must be called the greatest and most glorious of all the varied products of the human mind. The End. Read by David Russell. For Lit to Go. Available on the web at fcit.usf.edu.